This is a Best of What in God's Name replay from May 2019. In one of our most listened to shows in the past year, Shayna reveals that she has been diagnosed with breast cancer. Shayna went through months of treatment and came through cancer-free. We replayed this show because, while some of the particulars are different, some of the theology and some of the insights are appropriate for this pandemic time. Shayna and I will be back a week from today, May 7th, with a new show.
Welcome to What in God's Name. He's Chris Owen.
And she is Shayna Appel.
And we're the podcast looking at contemporary issues through the lens of philosophy and theology. Welcome, listeners. Chris, good to see you.
Good to see you, Shayna. I just wanted to mention to our audience that today is the last show of season one. We will have some periodic shows over the summer, God willing. And even though we won't be producing lots of new shows, we will be hard at work preparing for season two. And Shayna, I just want to take this opportunity to say how much I've enjoyed making this show with you through season one.
It's been amazing, Chris. It's hard for me to believe that we've already been through an entire season. It really went by quickly.
We're doing current events and culture, as Shayna said, from a theological and philosophical point of view. And our core values, be curious, go deep, and shine the light.
Chris, according to usbreastcancer.org, about 1 in 8 women in the United States, or 12%, will develop invasive breast cancer over the course of her lifetime. In 2019, an estimated 268,600 new cases of invasive breast cancer are expected to be diagnosed in women in the U.S., along with 62,930 new cases of non-invasive or in situ breast cancer. And Chris, as you know, but as I would like to share with our listeners, over the course of the last couple of weeks, I joined that statistical cohort, beginning with a phone call from my doctor that no woman wants to get, the one that says, gee, we think there may be something on your mammography. Could you come back in and get an ultrasound? So I did that. And in fact, Chris, your wonderful wife, Eleanor, was kind enough to accompany me to that appointment, to the needle biopsy afterwards, and then came down to Mass General Hospital with me. So a very interesting journey for people who want to stay curious, go deep, and shine the light. Interesting, fascinating, at times terrifying and unsettling, upending even, and then coming back and thinking you have a trajectory and a plan, only to have your insurance company say, nope, not today. So yeah, it's been kind of a wild ride, but I know, Chris, as you and I have been reflecting on it, we've been thinking a lot about, you know, the what and the why of bad things happening, you know, to otherwise decent people. You know, the question I have is, why does this stuff ever happen to the really horrible people out there?
That is a biblical question asked at various times by various writers in the Bible.
Yes. Like, oh, Lord, why me?
Yeah. Why me? And why aren't those terrible people being smitten?
Yes. Why have you not smited them as you promised?
Before we get into that question, I did want to ask you this. When you share that news, what is helpful for you to hear from the person you've shared that with? Are there particular words that are helpful to hear or a particular attitude?
What a great question, Chris. I think there are so many people who have so much experience with this. I mean, we're talking about an epidemic in our nation where 1 in 7 women will experience breast cancer in her lifetime, which is stunning. So it's rare that I tell somebody who has no experience with it or doesn't know somebody and, you know, out of the goodness of their hearts, they want to connect me with this person or that person. And it's like, geez, do you think I don't have a collection of those women who are people who are close to me? You know, but thank you. People want to offer direction and advice, and that is less helpful. I think the words that are most comforting are the simple, how are you doing? You know, how are you doing? Don't ask me how I'm feeling, because I may not be ready to go there, but this is the one we use out in the fire department when we're doing, you know, critical incident stress work with cops and firefighters and EMS professionals. We just, you know, how you doing? You know, wow, sorry to hear that. How are you holding up? It opens the door and it invites me to come through the door as far or not as I want to share more or not, depending on how I'm feeling or what else, you know, I'm en route to. Or
part of what's interesting about your response is the distinction between how are you doing and how are you feeling.
Yeah.
Which I've never heard anyone draw that distinction before. But what I heard you say is how are you feeling might go too quickly to a level that the person may or may not be willing to go to, whereas how are you doing just leaves it open.
Yeah, just for whatever they want to share. So that's been really helpful. And yeah, and I think that, you know, the other one that I have heard from other friends as well who have been through breast cancer, automobile accidents, is the call us if you need anything is probably not going to get a follow-up call. That if you're really serious about helping somebody, you pick up the phone and say, I have just made a pot of soup. Can I bring some over? I have just made a casserole. Is it now a good time for me to bring that by? Because the person who's struggling may or may not be able to ask for the help that they need. So Tales from the Crypt, man, I'm learning as I go. I'll tell you, it's been a journey and a quick one. It all happened very quickly. So
thank you for your willingness.
Thanks
to
for
share
asking,
that
Chris.
On our show. And
yeah. Hopefully by the time we come back at the summer's end after Dave Matthews Band, I'll be able to report that I'm whole, I'm full, I'm well, and as reasonably cancer-free as someone who's ever had it can be.
You and I are trained as pastoral caregivers, and certainly one of the things that we've learned and practiced is good listening, so that when someone approaches you with a burden and shares that burden, our work isn't to go in and fix and to supply the answers, but simply to listen, which can be very difficult.
Well, we undergo a 12-week course of study to teach us how to do that, a little wondrous part of our ministerial formation called clinical pastoral education, which for most of us takes place in a hospital. And I think my supervisor had the greatest description of it ever. He said that, you know, people who are in a crisis are effectively in a river of poop. And surrounding the river of poop are, you know, like any river, there's river banks. And on those riverbanks are people with real good intentions and self-help books and flotation devices and ladders and ropes and everything you can imagine to help you get out of the river of poop. And he said, you know, the role of the pastor is to simply get into the river with the person who's there and to sit with them until they're ready to get out on their own. So what you learn in CPE is what stops you from getting into the river with people. And that has been, I wish that curriculum and Al-Anon, the program for people who are living with persons with addictions, I wish those two curriculums were part of like our elementary school teaching.
So as Shana mentioned, her situation, having been diagnosed with breast cancer, raises these questions of when bad things happen to good people, how do we understand that? How do we process that? Certainly it's in the Christian script, well, in the Hebrew scripture, the book of Job is the classic example of this wrestling with the evil and the pain of human life. So we ask that as individuals. We also do this as a society. And so this touches more directly on what in God's name, as we look at current events and culture, the wider society. There are times in our nation's life when bad things happen, and certain theologians want to rush to particular kinds of theological understandings and explanations. So, for example, back, and you may remember this, Shana and our audience, but September 11th, 2001, after that, as people grasp and wrestle with what is the meaning of this, certain theologians—
As the dust settled.
Certain theologians wanted to come in and say the events of 9/11, that can be explained as God's anger at America for having turned away from God's ways. This is the Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell theology of that.
Which was dog whistling the gay community, the LGBT community. That's what they were specifically going. This is what they always come after.
Yeah. So the theology, and I've run into, and I imagine you have too, Shana, people who feel like when they are suffering, when they're going through a hard time in life, oh, God is punishing me. So there's this definite strain in popular theology, the way people think about who God is and what God is doing in the world, that when bad things happen, it's divine wrath. It's God's punishment.
Or God doing something that I don't deserve, and so therefore now I'm angry at God. That's a common one too.
So how do we deal with, or what is a different way of thinking about what God is doing in these situations? Not that in a pastoral situation, I would say, we don't go in and try to convince people of a different way of thinking about God when they're in the midst of, you know, just as you say, the river of poo.
Yeah.
You don't go in and say, well, here's a different theology. Try thinking about it this way.
Right. Yeah, never a good time to undermine somebody's theology is when they're in the river of poop.
But in the times of non-crisis, when it's a teaching moment, we can be helpful in helping people see and possibly consider a different view of where God is in these moments. And you are in the midst of this now as you deal with the emotions of having been diagnosed with breast cancer.
Well, I gotta be honest with you, and it's one of the things that's been interesting, and I guess I didn't notice it right away. Others noticed it, and everyone was like, wow, you seem very calm about all of this. And I realized I kind of sort of am pretty calm about this. I mean, what's going to be is going to be, and what ain't going to be ain't going to be, and worry is interest paid on trouble before it's due. So it's pretty much how I live my life generally, and now I'm in the midst of a crisis, and so that way of being is standing the test, if you will.
Is that connected to your faith, or is that just Shana, or can those two be separated?
You know, I think some of it is learned, some of it is life experience. I think all those years working in pre-hospital emergency medicine and firefighting, when things start getting really chaotic, there are two kinds of folks on the line. There are those who, in the face of crisis, get incredibly calm, and those who, when they're in the midst of crisis, really start to lose it. Both can be effective, but they're different manifestations. And I always remember looking at the folks who are calm and thinking, man, that's cool. I want to be able to stand, you know, when the feces has hit the oscillating rotator, man, I want to be able to stand there like, yep, that just happened. Next. Because those people inspire calm in others. You know, you get the best performance out of your people if you're not completely losing your mind in a crisis. Then I remember Marcus Borg saying something really irritated me when I first heard it, because it was like, oh, that's so right. It's so annoying. That the opposite of faithfulness is not faithlessness. The opposite of faithfulness is anxiety. And I think he's right. You know, it's like, God's got this. By the way, that doesn't mean, you know, the outcome may or may not be what I particularly want, but God's got it. I'm in God's care. I'm part of a larger order. However this works out, it's going to be fine for me. May not be great for the people around me, but it's going to be okay for me. I'm going to be fine, you know, either way. But I think there is something to what Marcus Borg says. I think there's also something very powerful to what you said earlier, because the time to hone one's faith is not in the midst of the crisis. And I have seen people try it. You probably have too. And then they're ticked off at God because it doesn't work. And it's like, you know, I always liken it to like, yeah, I went to the gym yesterday and I worked out. And when I was done working out, I got on the scale. I weighed exactly the same. That was a total waste of time. I'm not going back there. Like, with no comprehension that fitness is going to require some attention to the food I consume and exercise, and I will have to attend to those things over a period of time. I didn't get here overnight. I'm not going to get to wherever I want to be in one visit to the gym. And the church isn't any different. Yeah, you got to build those spiritual muscles ahead of time. Otherwise, when it hits the fan, it can be incredibly destabilizing.
I guess I'm going to say this and see if you agree, but I think one of the things that you and I drive at in this show is the need for our society to be better grounded in something higher, to be grounded in something bigger than themselves. Doesn't have
something
to be
bigger.
Jesus, doesn't have to be.
Nope.
But, and it doesn't even have to be religious. You can ground yourself as a secular humanist in the goodness of the world or in the beauty of the world, not referring to a deity, but something bigger that helps ground us in the crisis. I think that's
something bigger that also can form us, that continues to form us so that we don't show up at 50 the way we did at 5. you know, we all know those people. They're in their 50s showing up like they're five. But yeah, I think the binding ourselves to something bigger than we are forms us and continues to grow us. When you had said the thing earlier about we don't try to get people rethinking things in the midst of the crisis, but I do remember this was a story that came out of the critical incident stress debriefings that took place after the Frederick Murr building was blown up
in Oklahoma City.
Yeah. And one of the chaplains was in the debriefing with all of the state troopers, and the state troopers that day were assigned to the child care center. So they had to remove all the children who had lost their lives in that horrific terrorist act and bring them down to the morgue. And, you know, this is horrific upon horrific. I mean, you know, a situation that no human being, first of all, nothing like this should ever happen to any child anywhere for whatever reason, period, end of conversation. And then, you know, all these big, big, beefy state troopers having to deal with this. Anyway, so what the chaplain who was involved in the debriefing tells the story, it was a pretty tense, intense debriefing, and folks were understandably angry. Anger was the emotion they could get access to, so that there was plenty of it in the debriefing. And one trooper stood up and he called out the chaplain. And he said, you know, basically, you're a man of God. Explain to us mere mortals here how your God let this happen.
Did the chaplain respond?
Yeah, he did. It was a very tense moment for him. And he realized he had to address this thing head on. I mean, that he had to straighten out.
He had to give an answer.
He had to give an answer. And it better be short, sweet, and make the point. He was the one who I first heard say, you know, God never promised that if we followed his ways, nothing bad would happen to us. God said only that God would be with us.
Let's examine this question a little bit more closely since you've brought it up. Theodicy is a theological term. Theodicy is explaining divine goodness in the light of the existence of evil and the suffering and the pain of innocent people. And the argument is, if God is all-powerful and God is all-loving, then there shouldn't be suffering, because if God is all-powerful, God would prevent this suffering from happening. But suffering does happen, so either God is not powerful enough to stop it, or God really doesn't love us to want to stop it.
Or you move from, you know, this notion of an omniscient or omniscient and or omnipotent God to process theology, which takes us into a very different realm. I mean, a la Henry Nelson Wyman, I believe it was. Nelson Wyman, or was it Hartshorn, who wrote a paper, actually, on the problem of an omniscient and an omnipotent God.
Yeah, I'm there with that. I think this definition of God as all-loving and all-powerful doesn't get at the real mystery of who God is. And if I want to opt for one, I would say God is not all-powerful.
Well, what Wyman points out is that if God is all powerful, that is to say God controls everything that happens down here, then God is a tyrant and we're nothing more than puppets on a string. He said if God is all omniscient, that's redundant. If God is omniscient, that is, knows everything that is going to happen before it happens, then God's basically reduced to autopilot. And what he suggested is, what if God is so big, so great, so awesome, that God is willing to meet us on the forming edge of our lives? That God may have a preferential option for us that calls us forward, but is not going to dictate and doesn't know how it's all going to work out. You know, and when I heard that, because honestly, like when I was in seminary, well, some people may find this, you know, curious. I mean, I went to seminary a little uncertain about God. I had an experience of something that I called God, but the actual God, i.e. that which, you know, we might theoretically be worshiping in church on any given Sunday, I was a little, like, I was a little nebulous about it, because there were just some things that didn't add up, and the omniscience and omnipotence thing were two pieces that just didn't add up. And then when I encountered process theology, for me, those barriers just melted away, and I was like, I love that God. I love that God who is courageous enough and big enough to give me room to fail, and then to be there with me in that failure. I love that God who may not be able to control everything that happens to me, but when the hard stuff happens, will be with me, will be with me. The only promise God ever makes in Scripture, right? And I will be with you. I will be your God. You will be my people. I will be with you. Never says bad stuff ain't going to happen to you. Just doesn't say it. It's not in the book. I've read it.
And we understand this God to be a God who involves that divine self in history. So the unfold, this continual unfolding has God in.
That's an interesting point, Chris, because I hear people say so often, like, well, I believe in a God or some force or something out there, but I don't think that God is all that interested in us.
And in this age that we live in, where in many circles, faith is not part of what's transmitted to the next generation, there's a lot of people left on their own to find their way through their own belief or unbelief.
And how's that working out for us? We've got like the most medicated class of young people ever on the planet. Most of them are being medicated for hyperactivity disorder, depression, and anxiety. Do I think that a regular dose of faith could help to curb that? I guess I actually do. There's a certain grounding in a life of faith that, or ethics or morality, or again, going back to that earlier, that thing bigger than us. Back in the day when people understood themselves to be part of a community, you know, it might just be the town they lived in. And they understood that if they did something bad, it would bring disgrace not only on their family, but, you know, on the town, on the county where they lived. Yeah, there was just some understanding of our interconnectedness that seems to be disappearing and has probably disappeared in some places. And so, yeah, what gets left is you're on your own. And man, that's if you ain't anxious in that space, you ain't paying attention. Nobody makes it out there alone, in the words of the late, great prophetess Maya Angelou.
Or did she say that? Nobody
makes it out there alone.
Nice. That's a theology we can live in and with.
Absolutely.
How shall we bring this one to a close?
Given the number of listeners we have out there and the number of whom are women, it stands to reason that somebody is going to hear this podcast and hopefully know that they are not alone. In like manner, all of those women who will be diagnosed with breast cancer are in relationship to men. Some are mothers, wives, sisters, mothers. So for all of you out there, girls, ladies, regular screenings, enough said. We'll check in with you all at the end of the summer and give you an update, or maybe we'll post something. I think we'll post something.
Yes.
Just to let folks know how I'm doing. I would greatly appreciate all of your thoughts and prayers over the summer as I get myself back into a place of wellness. And I hope that you all have a blessed summer and some time to just sit and know that God is. Chris, go deep.
And be curious.
And shine some light.
What in God's name? Thanks you for listening. Our website, whatingods.com, WHATINGODS. We will be planning season 2, and we'll send you some updates as plans develop. People will be interviewing, topics we'll be discussing. Fantastic, Shana.
Don't forget the sunscreen, Chris. You pale little ginger boy, you. Friends, have a great summer. This has been season 1 of What in God's Name. Thanks so much for tuning in.
See you, Shana.
See you, Chris.